Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP Section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guest.
Thank you, Sarah. This is Matt Rosenberg. I'm with RoseCap Financial Advisors, and I'm here to talk about tax planning within an investment portfolio. Before I get started, I want to mention just how quickly the technology is changing in financial services and financial planning industry. I think about the job of an investment advisor 10 or 20 years ago was really to provide access to individuals to help them buy or sell securities. Getting an investment portfolio today is actually very easy and something people can do on their own online for free, even create a diversified portfolio. So the job of a CPA financial planner, financial planning is changing when it comes to investing. Similar in the CPA industry, you have, I think years ago, the client would gather all their income and deduction items and credits and present those to a CPA who could facilitate the filing of the tax return. Well, now it's very easy for clients to even do some of that themselves. So the jobs of these professions or these services are really shifting towards the advising and the planning role towards the client. And I think that's an important thing to note as we look at financial planning and the job of a CPA going forward. When CPAs provide financial planning, it can include a lot of topics. So you have tax preparation, tax planning, insurance, estate planning, retirement planning, and portfolio management. And all these things kind of go into a financial plan. So that's a lot, and it's something that's pretty hard for one CPA or one individual to do themselves, although many aspects of providing a personal financial planner are already being performed by CPAs. So formalizing these services into a business is something that might be considered. So CPAs, I think, are the professionals who are in the best position to provide financial planning services, and this is for a few reasons. First, CPA financial planners tend to be more qualified and have a broader experience. They have exposure to a lot of the activities that I just previously mentioned in their already routine. So providing these services is something that would just come second nature to them. They also don't have conflicts of interest that a lot of product salespeople do, where maybe their compensation is directly tied to the product or the advice they're giving. And many CPAs, again, are already doing this type of work. So really all it takes is just formalizing these services within a business. In this podcast, I'm going to talk about major tax considerations that practitioners should take into account when providing investment services. And I want to note that as CPA, you don't directly have to manage the assets to help clients with their investments, where you maybe get paid through an assets under management arrangement or trade for clients. Many CPAs currently provide financial advice through maybe a consulting retainer or bill hourly for the work as part of their financial planning services. So it's actually something that doesn't take much setup either. And if you're interested in learning more about that, I'd recommend looking into the investment planning certificate, which can help you hone in your financial planning skills and also bring you one step closer to a PFS designation. So first, I want to do a quick review of the taxes that might apply in an investment portfolio. Basically, there's two different ways you can make money through investing. It's yield or the income that comes in from cash flows that are generated, and then it's buying a security and selling it for more than you bought it for, which is capital gains. So the two primary sources of yield are going to be interest and dividends. Interest income in a portfolio is generally ordinary income, which is taxed at the investor's marginal rate, and that also includes zero coupon bonds, so just because there's no interest or cash paid, doesn't mean that it's not imputed. You also have state and municipal bonds, which are federally tax-exempt interest, but could still be subject to alternative minimum tax. So before investing in municipal bonds, I think it's important to understand all the tax implications of them. And in a lot of states, if you buy the municipal bonds from that state or in your home state, they're also not taxed at the state level. So there's a lot to look at when investing in a municipal bond, and I think you want to make sure you understand all aspects of that before purchasing. For example, some munis are actually taxable. Your state might not give you the tax-exempt interest, and there might be AMT associated with it. Another important point with interest in dealing with munis is a concept called the taxable equivalent yield in a bond. And this is a calculation that's done where you take the yield on the tax-exempt security and you divide it by 1 minus the investor's marginal tax rate. So really what we're doing is grossing this yield up to compare on a pre-tax basis with other bonds. And once we've done that, we can compare bonds based on similar credit ratings or durations to figure out which might make the most sense and get the highest yield. So I'll give an example. If there's a tax-exempt bond that, say, paid 3% and the investor's in the 25% marginal tax bracket, 3% divided by 1 minus 25% is 4%. That would be your taxable equivalent yield. So if I had a taxable comparable bond that, say, yielded 4.5%, it would actually be better for me to invest in the pre-tax bond or the taxable bond instead of the muni, because I'm going to pay tax and then still have a higher yield at the end of the day. I think it's rare in the current market that you don't need to be in the top two tax brackets before it makes sense to invest in municipal bonds, and sometimes even be in the highest tax state to do that. Municipal bonds have just gotten really low yields, and a lot of times it's common to see investors who have a knee-jerk reaction, say, I don't want to pay taxes, so I need to have munis in my portfolio. Well, if you're not in those top few tax brackets, it may be better off for you to buying taxable bonds and just paying the tax. The other income from a portfolio is dividends, which generally comes from stocks and starts out as ordinary income, which is your highest tax rate. But if you hold them for long enough, then you get qualified dividends, which is taxed at a more favorable long-term capital gains rate, so 0, 15, or 20%. To qualify for qualified dividends, a stock must be held for 61 days during the 121-day period beginning 60 days before the ex-dividend date. That's a complicated definition, although basically if you hold stock for 4 months, that generally covers you and you should be getting qualified dividends from that stock. There's a few exceptions, though. Some stocks aren't able to get qualified dividends, like REITs, MLPs, or maybe foreign stocks if they don't have a U.S. tax treaty. So understanding which stocks you're investing in and how their dividends are paid is an important part of the tax treatment in a portfolio. Capital gains is the next way we make money in a portfolio. And long-term capital gains is your favorable rates. I think a lot of people rush to try to invest in maybe some other tax-deferred vehicle like an annuity, but they don't realize you can actually manage a taxable account very tax efficiently through the use of long-term capital gains and maybe limiting the stocks in your portfolio and how the dividends are paid in those. Short-term capital gains, so if we hold the stocks in our portfolio for less than 1 year, we're going to pay short-term capital gains, which is an ordinary income rate, again, our highest tax rates. And I think there's some pain here from a tax standpoint in a portfolio when we have to realize short-term capital gains. You typically see that with over-trading. So clients who are trading too much in their portfolio, trying to take advantage of short-term profits in stocks, it becomes a lot harder to profit from that on an after-tax basis when you're paying short-term capital gains or those high tax rates on those gains. Also with option strategies, those tend to be short-term capital gains because options tend to be shorter term. One more important point to mention with options is that if you're investing with options, it can negate the holding period on a stock if you're using that for a hedge. So for example, I could buy a stock, hold it for an 11-month period, buy a protective put on it, which means I'm going to just buy a put option on that stock, and it's going to basically ensure that price for me. But since I've hedged with an option, that period that I'm hedging doesn't count towards my long-term capital gains treatment. So if I held that stock for 11 months, put a protective put on it for 2 months, and then sold it, the entire gain would be taxed as short-term capital gain. So that's the tax aspects of a portfolio. I also want to mention a few tax strategies that I think can be relevant in when investing. And the first one, really, these ones just have to do with tax efficiency in a portfolio. It's amazing how sometimes we'll see accounts that or actions that just don't make a lot of tax sense. For example, it's pretty common for a client to switch from one investment professional to another. And when they do that, the new professional will basically just sell all the positions in the portfolio and start over as if it's cash. That can be pretty painful for the client from a tax standpoint if they had a lot of unrealized capital gains in that portfolio. it makes a lot more sense to wait for that basis to come in. And sometimes we even have to sit on positions we would rather not have just because there's so much unrealized gain in that position. Another one is the use of mutual funds in taxable accounts. I think this is a big mistake, and that has to do with the tax inefficiency of mutual funds. And what happens is you have a manager of the mutual fund who can buy and sell securities inside of that fund, and the taxes from that still have to be paid. So those get distributed out, and the client is the person who ends up paying those, whether they really wanted to at that time or not. So mutual funds in a taxable account is another thing I would try to avoid. Annuities are another one that I think can be tax inefficient, which may sound counterintuitive because annuities are often sold as a tax savings vehicle or tax deferred vehicle. The thing is an annuity is really an insurance product, and it's a very important part of financial plan for a lot of people. But when you start using annuities investment accounts, it can trigger some tax implications that may not be intended. For example, if you take an early distribution from an annuity, that's all going to be taxed as ordinary income, and you're basically forfeiting your ability to get that long-term capital gains treatment. Managing the gains and losses in your portfolio and timing those with your other taxable income is a great strategy. So you have tax loss harvesting, which is where you realize the losses in the portfolio when you have high income years. You also can realize gains in a portfolio if you have low income years and up that basis. So just paying attention to the unrealized positions in a portfolio and pairing those up with the other taxable income of an investor is an effective strategy for reducing taxes. One that I think is really nice, we mentioned technology, is specifically identifying the tax lots that can be sold in a portfolio. This used to be a lot harder to do years ago, and now with trading software, you can actually identify exactly which lot of a position that you want to be sold to make it the most tax-effective sale for you. So specific identification. We used to have to just select LIFO or FIFO or weighted average for the whole position. We don't have to do that anymore. Asset location is another one that I think is very relevant for investing, and this is where we're going to place securities in a tax account type that is more favorable for the client. So for example, if I have high yield bonds, which maybe pay 6 or 7% interest, I probably want to hold those in my traditional IRA where that interest income won't be taxed as ordinary income for me rather than in my taxable account. If I have low yielding securities like growth stocks, maybe don't pay any dividends, those are what I want to hold in a taxable account. If I have very high appreciating securities like a technology stock or something I really think is just going to shoot up, holding that in a Roth IRA would be the best place for that. Most investment professionals who understand it would say, man, the dream come true would just be to have bought Amazon stock at the IPO, like maybe $10,000 worth, and put that into a Roth IRA, and that would be worth millions today, all tax-free. One more thing I want to mention with asset location is if you have these high appreciating securities, to avoid putting those into a traditional IRA, that can backfire on you, where if you keep those in a taxable account even, it can be long-term capital gains upon that sale. But if you're in, say, a lower tax bracket when you buy those, they appreciate a lot, and then you put them into a traditional IRA that's just generating more ordinary income for you when you have to take those distributions. Of course, high appreciating securities are hard to identify, or else we'd invest in all those. But if you do think there's the possibility, that's where you want to locate them. So asset location. Roth conversions to bracket fill is another great strategy. Basically, what you're doing here is taking your pre-tax account or your traditional IRA, your tax-deferred accounts, and you're taking distributions from those and converting them into Roth IRAs to fill up at least your 10 and 12% tax brackets. That's almost a no-brainer, I think, especially in the early years of retirement for people. But even if there's somebody who's maybe an ultra-high net worth client with just a lot of pre-tax money, it might even make sense up to the 22 or 24% bracket. So those are some strategies to consider. The last one I want to mention is Opportunity Zone investments. So Opportunity Zone is new with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And basically what an Opportunity Zone investment is it allows you to realize capital gains from an investment and then still defer those by reinvesting them into a qualified opportunity zone. So opportunity zones are identified already in their specific districts, and you can look those up online in your state. They're mapped out. What happens is if you take those realized capital gains and put them in there, you get your tax deferred on there until 2026. And there's actually two more tax benefits with it, though. If you hold that investment for 10 years, you get a 15% step up in the basis. So you can eliminate 15% of those realized capital gains. And then any gains on that opportunity zone investment are tax-free after 10 years. So this is a triple tax investment vehicle that you can add in your investment portfolio. I think these services are great when you can advise your client on the tax side of it and also transfer that over to the financial planning side. On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Matt Rosenberg with RoseCap Financial Advisors. If you enjoyed this podcast, I'd highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website, www.aicpastore.com/PFP investment, to learn more about the investment planning certificate. Please stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find this and other valuable resources. Thanks for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered, and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.